We just, I was wrestling this morning with whether or not I'm lecturing about the cross of Jesus too energetically. But here's my problem. Matthew structures it so much in the context of victory, it's hard not to be energetic when you're talking about the crucifixion of Jesus in Matthew. So I'm not going to apologize for being overly enthusiastic when we're dealing with the crucifixion. While it is a somber moment, and if I was a disciple, I'd be a mess. Because of the way Psalm 22 is permeating this text, it's hard not to be a little bit enthusiastic, passionate, etc. So, with a smile on our face, we go to verse 51. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. These are the second and the third major signs at the crucifixion of something big that's occurring. There's four of them, I suggested. What was the first one that we dealt with yesterday?
Darkness.
Darkness, exactly, darkness. Now, what I want you to see, because the fourth one is going to be very anomalous. It's going to be very strange. What I want you to see, though, is all four of these signs in conjunction, all of them together, because I feel like they're all giving us the same message, even though one of them is going to seem really far out there. First one being the darkness. The second one is the moment that the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This is quite significant for a couple of points. Number one, this was probably a sign in Matthew's gospel of judgment. Judgment on the temple, judgment on the nation of Israel, on their political program, on what they were trying to establish. The exact location of this is kind of the second key point. This was not only a thing of judgment, but also a thing of affirmation, a sign of affirmation. We don't know exactly which temple curtain was torn here. It could be one of two options. And both of them theologically have major significance. And it possibly is the fact that he doesn't tell us exactly which one, that it leaves it vague enough for us to be able to apply it to both. I'm not saying both torn. I'm saying there's a theological point here, even that's greater than a historical one. The first possible... sorry about that. The first possible... curtain, that's what I was looking for, that was torn was this curtain that was separating possibly the court of the Gentiles and the court of the Jews. Now, it wasn't like this one big, long, huge curtain that just separated them. There was a curtain at a particular point in the entrance that would have been there. If this was the one that was torn, what theological significance would that have had? Yeah. That the political program of keeping the dogs out of the kingdom, instead of being a light to the Gentiles and burning them, Jesus' kingdom comes along and says, that's no longer. The Gentiles and the Jews are my people. The second possible option was that this is the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of it. What would be the significance then of that one being torn? What was behind the Holy of Holies? Yes, the presence of God Himself. Who was allowed in there one time a year? What would they do to the high priest? Tie a rope on him in case he dies. No one else is going in there. We've read the story of Achan and how God takes seriously the Ark of the Covenant, yeah? So what happens then whenever that curtain is torn? Theologically, what is being said? There's no barrier between God and man because the mediator has come, possibly. This is something that's kind of fascinating to note as well. In 63 BC, there is possible evidence in Josephus that when Pompey, the Roman general, went in to take over the rule of Rome over this region, there is evidence, it's a vague reference in Josephus, but when Pompey goes in, it does seem to suggest that he finds nothing in the Holy of Holies. That's interesting to me. Because it is possible then, it is possible, I'm not saying it is provable, I'm saying it is possible, that if the Holy of Holies wasn't there in 63 BC, it is possible that every single year when the high priest went in to do his duties, he went in and realized the presence of God was not there. Possible. Can't prove it, but the reference is there. Okay. Curtains torn. Third major sign. The earth shook and the rocks split. This has reminiscence of Zechariah chapter 14, verse 4. What happens there? Zechariah 14, huge passage for the Jews. Cheat if you must. Answer always, yeah? But Zechariah 14, think. We've talked about Zechariah 14 before, just merely three chapters earlier. What is the key location in Zechariah 14? The Mount of Olives. And what happens to the Mount of Olives? It splits. What is the context of Zechariah 14? The Messiah coming and the golden age dawning. As a matter of fact, that's what we've already talked about with the sun darkening. What does that symbolize? A new creation. Whenever you have the temple, the curtain being torn, what does that symbolize? The establishment of a kingdom, a new creation. With the rocks being split, parallel in Zechariah 14, it is symbolizing the very same thing. A new creation. Something very significant is dawning. In comes the fourth really weird sign. Verse 52, the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Wow, if you read commentaries on these couple of verses, you get pretty much every weird stretch that you can possibly imagine. You know, that they basically say, literally, there are some commentaries that will say things like, the power of Jesus, his crucifixion, it's just like life just kind of overflowed into the general graves next to him and they just rose to life because they couldn't help it. I mean, just like people, they just don't know what to do with it. Because this is the only place where we get this. The only place where we get this. So what is happening here? I am not going to try to fight or prove the historical event of this. Do I have any reason to doubt that it happened? No. But that's not my issue here. I want to ask, why did Matthew include it? So you hear what I'm doing here? I'm saying to me, whether or not this is historical or not is inconsequential. It doesn't matter. Do I have any reason to doubt its historicity? No. But I'm setting that question aside, okay? Here is what theologically I think is happening. When the golden age would dawn, the Jews expected at least three key events. Now notice I'm saying something different than what we've talked about before. Before I was talking about when the Messiah would come, what would they expect? There is some parallel. And yet I'm not talking about what the Messiah is to do. I'm talking about what occurs when the golden age dawns. So you see the difference in the distinction. Because the golden age could dawn for some Jews without a Messiah. If you don't remember why that is true, listen to the first lecture of the semester. Okay? When the golden age would dawn in the future, remember the Jews are thinking eschatologically in the future. When the golden age would dawn, three things would happen. Number one, judgment of rebellious agents of evil would happen. The rebellious would get theirs. We see some parallel. Number two, a new creation would dawn, Isaiah 65. And number three, there would be a general resurrection of the dead. By the first century, these are three key things. Three key things that the Jews would have in mind that would happen at the golden age. I'm not saying these are exhaustive. I'm saying at least these three things they expected. Okay? General resurrection of the dead. I'm not saying that they were expecting... Yes. And some of them will deny that, Sadducees, etc. You guys know that whole debate. Okay. Now here's, let me put this into context, okay? If that is what they are expecting to happen when the golden age dawns, then I find it quite significant that the veil being torn has very significant judgment undertones of the rebelliousness of the people that are refusing to accept the kingdom of God. Number two, I find it quite significant that the splitting of the rocks and the darkening of the sun are key symbols of new creation. And number three, it would therefore be quite fitting for some sort of general resurrection to occur. And that's what I think we find in all four of these signs. What do I think the signs are saying and doing? I think they're saying the golden age has dawned. Now what I am not saying, hear me very clearly, I am not saying that this is the absolute consummation of the golden age. I am not saying that there will not be a future general resurrection, because there will be. I am not saying that there will not be a future judgment, because there will be. I'm not saying that there won't be a future new creation, because there will be. You hear what I'm saying? What I'm saying is with the kingdom of Jesus, with His works on the cross, and eventually His resurrection, what they thought only belonged in the future has now broken into history. Has now broken into history. It should not freak us out that these people are raised from the dead. I mean, has Jesus not done that already in Matthew with other people? Yes? We know from the other Gospels He's done this with other people as well. Lazarus in John chapter 11. The fact that people resurrect shouldn't make us go, oh, is that historically accurate? I mean, set that aside. Is this different than the rest of the resurrections? Sure. But why does Matthew put it here? Because he's trying to paint the picture that the Jews would understand. That in this crucifixion, where it looks like defeat, when it looks like God has abandoned everyone, that in fact, this is the beginning of the victory. This is the beginning of the golden age. This is the beginning of bringing the not yet into the already. So you see what I'm doing? You see what I'm saying with that? My answer to why these people resurrect, more than likely they're probably Old Testament saints, we have no evidence, either here nor there. We have no evidence of that. What is happening? He's painting the golden age occurring at the time of Jesus' death. Why? Because it's through victory, or it's victory that we seize through suffering. Okay? Okay. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that happened, they were terrified. And yet they exclaimed, "Surely He is the Son of God." That's interesting to me that who the one that is attributed as saying that with the centurion there. Because that may have been one of the very same centurions that was just in the praetorium with Jesus doing some interesting things of mocking Him. Yeah? And now, it's the centurion, the first person since we've been dealing with the cross that says, "I'm not so sure we should abandon this guy. Something's not right." Verse 55, further evidence that he wasn't completely abandoned. Many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for His needs. Now, even though this shows that Jesus wasn't completely abandoned, there are two elements that actually doesn't make this reference very flattering for Jesus. What would be the first reason why this wouldn't be awesome evidence of Jesus not being abandoned?
They're women.
As a matter of fact, if the Jews would have saw that, they would have said, "Yeah, that's the only people that would stay with you. People that don't matter." That's what they would say. Women being the people that stayed by Jesus is not something that helps His honor. It's something that continues to deteriorate it. Not even to mention the fact, notice, it says the women were there, but they were watching from a distance. Even the women, even the outcasts, don't want to get too close to Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. Notice my distinction. In the Gospel of Matthew. They don't even want to get that close. So even though it says Jesus wasn't totally abandoned, it says, but He may as well have been. Because all He has sitting there is women, and they won't even get too close. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. What is significant about those three names? Anything you can think of. What is significant? Matthew chapter 20, here is really what is significant. I mean, not really what is significant. Here is another significant point. She is the only one that we have seen so far in Matthew. We have not seen Mary Magdalene. We have not seen Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. These are the very first time those two characters have popped up. But we have seen the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And we saw her in Matthew chapter 20 when she is asking for her sons to have the positions of glory, to be on the right and the left hand of Jesus when He enters His glory. Now here's what's significant. We're about to move into the resurrection account. Whenever women come to the tomb, But Mary, or excuse me, the mother of the sons of Zebedee is not there when the resurrection, when they go to the resurrection tomb. Out of the three women that are mentioned here, she is the only one missing. Why would she be missing? Maybe so. What else? He said maybe she was looking through a different lens. I do think that's part of it. What else? Say it again.
Like attending to her sons, like checking on them.
Yeah, maybe she went to look for her sons. I mean, she's obviously fighting for their honor. What else? Think about this. Put yourself in the position of this mama. Think about what she asked in Matthew chapter 20. Whenever you come into your glory, may my sons be on your right and your left. And man, what have we just seen? Incredible moments of glory. Of Jesus with the sun turning dark and the earth, you know, breaking up rocks and the temple curtain being torn and people raising from the dead. And even a centurion saying, surely this is the Son of God. It is the moment that He's in His glory. And she's sitting there watching and she's thinking, had He granted my request, I'd have one son hanging next to Him and the other one's hanging next to Him. She may just be flat out overwhelmed because she didn't realize what she was asking. I'm not saying she understands the theological significance behind it. What I'm saying is this. It's very possible the reason why she doesn't show up for the resurrection is because she is so in shock for what could have happened to her babies had Jesus said yes to her request. Who knows? Just a thought. Mary Magdalene, we don't know anything about her from the Gospel of Matthew. The only really stuff that we know about Mary Magdalene comes from Luke chapter 8, verse 2, where it says she was healed of evil spirits and the disease, and specifically says that she has seven demons cast out of her. I was talking to a couple of people recently about Jesus marrying Mary Magdalene and the whole Dan Brown Da Vinci Code thing. Let me just say this, as a historian, let me just say this. We just have no evidence of that. There is two, possibly three documents that give vague reference to this possible idea, and none of those ever use the word Mary in the sense of marriage. None of them ever use the words like united as in marriage. They never even use the language. You have to read it into any of the three texts that we look at. So is there evidence in any historical document of Jesus being married to a Mary Magdalene? The answer is flat out no. And it's very easy writing a fictional novel because, you know, and you can make up documents, you can do whatever you want and fabricate all kinds of history. It's very easy whenever you're not a scholar to look at texts, read them at a first glance, and make all kinds of assumptions. As a matter of fact, if you take anything out of context, you can make anything say whatever you want. But if you actually look at the documents, you'll realize it's bogus. If you want more on this information, read Fabricating Jesus by Craig Evans. He handles this stuff pretty thoroughly, pretty well. Okay? So, do we have evidence of Mary Magdalene being married to Jesus? No. As a matter of fact, even the whole Da Vinci Code, whenever it comes to like the symbols inside of the Last Supper, you have to be a bad art critic to buy into that. Even artistically, what he is suggesting is absolutely ludicrous. Artistically, I'm just saying history aside, what he is suggesting artistically about the identity of the person on Jesus' right in the Lord's Supper of Da Vinci, which might, I will add this, the historical reality of the Last Supper painted by Da Vinci anyway, he totally got it wrong. Like when it comes to even just the way they would have been sitting, even the triclinium he doesn't have, the fact they'd be reclining. So, I mean, if he got those details wrong, why would I think that he would have some insight into the relationship of the person to his right? Strange to me. But at the same time, I will also say this. Look at John. In all of the paintings throughout history, he's always painted with feminine qualities because they were trying to communicate his youthfulness. So if I ignore all of art history and all of our historical documents, I can buy into the Da Vinci Code. But at that point, I might as well start talking about, you know, Millennial Falcon and all kinds of other weird stuff that Jesus was probably a part of. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, the only thing we really can infer about her is that James is probably the disciple of Jesus. Not the son of Zebedee, the other one. Matter of fact, he's sometimes referred to as James the Younger or James the Lesser. We have this specifically marked out in Mark chapter 15, verse 40. So that's their identity. All right. Verse 57. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea. Stop. What is significant? What? Yeah, last time we saw those two words sitting next to each other, where were we? In what chapter, quiz takers? Chapter 19. As a matter of fact, the very last time Jesus uses those two words together, he says, it is more difficult to get a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to make it into heaven. And then the disciples say what? Then who can make it in? And Jesus looks at him and he says, with man, nothing is possible. But with God, everything's possible. We have a rich man from Arimathea. Arimathea, that's an important city. The significance of Arimathea, it's 22 miles northwest of Jerusalem. That's not necessarily significant. I mean, I guess, if you're a geography buff. But what is most significant is the fact that this was the birthplace of Samuel the prophet. Why is Samuel significant in the Old Testament? Outside of being a really important prophet, what did he do that would make sense in the lens that we're reading this gospel through? He anointed the very first king of Israel. Whoa, not an accident. So we have a rich man from Arimathea, and his name is Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. That last phrase is important because Mark chapter 15, verse 43, tells us that Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Sanhedrin. That's right. One of the people of the Supreme Court of the Jews that condemned Jesus to death is coming out and saying, I'm actually one of his disciples. He's putting a lot on the line with the actions he's about ready to do. What we have is the fact that we have a rich man now in Matthew being labeled as a disciple of Jesus. And what that points us to in light of chapter 19 is the power of God to make anything possible. Even a rich man coming to know Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Again, he's laying a lot down the line. He's putting himself in jeopardy with the Jewish kingdom because he is crossing lines. Big, big gamble. And he's putting himself at jeopardy with Roman Empire. Why? Because he's asking to align himself with somebody that was killed as a political revolutionary. This is sociological honor suicide. You don't do things like what Joseph Arimathea is about ready to do. You don't. Unless you count the cost of discipleship. Unless you understand what Jesus was saying the whole time. That you everything this world values, you need to just reject if you're going to follow me. And Joseph Arimathea says, I'm down with that. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. That is significant for a couple of reasons. Number one, not everybody had a tomb in the ancient world. We have evidence of a lot of mass graves, especially if you're poor. It was a luxury to have a tomb. But what's being described here with the wrapping of the clothes of fine linen and putting him in a new tomb is an absolute honor burial. He is totally getting an honor burial. Matter of fact, we have evidence that the early Christians, one of the ways they became illegal as far as meeting together, because in the Roman world, you could not create a new religion. As a matter of fact, you couldn't even meet together and pull money together without their approval, because they have to make sure they keep peace. And one of the ways to keep peace is to make sure no coups are starting to develop. You see? So you'd have to register as something called a free association. And there's different categories for what a free association could be. It is possible, let me say this too, according to Roman law, the people that ruled your free association were called presbyteroi, elders. Where did we get that term? Good old Rome gave it to us. Yeah, let that one sink in just for a bit. Okay. So you'd have to have your presbyteroi in order to have this free association. So the Christians had to ask the question, how can we meet together? How can we pull our resources together to take care of each other without being persecuted by the Roman government simply for meeting together? And the answer was, probably, We have a lot of evidence pointing to that they met as what was called burial associations, where a group of people would get together that were not wealthy. They would take, if you were a part of the association, you had to, in a sense, pay some sort of due to be a part of the association, and they would pool money together, and when anybody would die within the association, they would provide for them an honorable burial. As a matter of fact, in Rome today, you can go down into Christian catacombs that are named, they're the catacombs of Domitilla, which is possibly one related, in a sense, to the Emperor Domitian. We don't know that for certain, but it's possible. But you see what I'm saying here? What I'm trying to develop here is this. What Joseph of Arimathea is doing for Jesus is something that even the early Christians kept doing for other people that were poor that could not afford an honorable burial. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Basically, don't think of a grave 6 feet under the way we do it. Think of a cave with a big hole cut inside of it. Notice how much that would take, money-wise, in order for that to be accomplished in the ancient world. So they cut a hole inside of like a cave-like structure. They make a major deep groove in front of it, and they would seal it with a large stone that would land inside of a groove that had inclines on both sides. And the reason for that was twofold. Number one, there was an honorable reason. Because if it was sealed tight, then animals would not be able to get in and to feast on the flesh of the rotting corpse. That's very, matter of fact, that's why the mass graves were so dishonorable, because a lot of times you'd have dogs, I'm not going to get into that. You'd have dogs that would come and they would dig up and eat a lot of the bodies. But with a stone in front of it, the animals couldn't do that. There was no shame. The second thing is a practical reason. The body would have stunk. And the sealing of the rock in front of it would keep that stench inside. Hence John chapter 11, whenever they move away the stone and they're overwhelmed by the smell that comes out of it. Because the rock was keeping it in. Okay. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So now we have two women out of the three that are still following. They know where the tomb is. So any suggestion that the women on the day of the resurrection went to the wrong tomb is silly. Because they go following Joseph of Arimathea to the tomb the night that Jesus was buried. And people could have just said, that's not the right tomb, woman. It's over here. And they'd have been like, oh, silly me. Verse 62, the next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees, preparation day would have been Friday. Preparation for what? Sabbath. The chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver, notice they won't even say his name. That deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again. What's ironic about this is that the whole trial in which they convicted this deceiver was full of deceit. So he's wonderful. Plank in the eye parallel here, anybody? Okay. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first. Why? Because we're at Passover. And if somebody that the Roman government captures and kills raises from the dead, people will do anything for him. Why? Because they see God's hand is clearly moving. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go make the tomb as secure as you know how. What guard do they take? A Roman guard. How do I know? Couple of reasons. Number one, the Jews would not need to go to Pilate to ask them if they could put one of their own guards at the tomb. They can do that. The tomb wasn't something that was off limits for anybody. They could do that. But they needed his permission for a Roman guard to be stood there. Number two, whenever the resurrection is over, the guards that were there go and report to Pilate. If there was a failure by the guards and they were Jewish, they'd have no reason to report to Pilate at all. So Pilate is giving them Roman guards. Big, significant point if you're talking about the historicity of the resurrection, because those guards don't make mistakes. Because in Pilate's command, he could make them pay the penalty of whatever he wanted, even death. Secure it as best as you know how. Verse 66. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. Okay, this is awesome. What you would do with the seal that's being described there, would either be clay or some sort of wax that you would melt on to the tomb where the rock and where the actual cave were meeting together. It'd be a seal. Then what they would do is they would take the Roman seal and they would imprint it into that. Then they would take a rope, attach it to the rock, and attach it to the cave itself so that if the rope was broken as well as the seal, what would happen to the person? Think about that. Whose seal is on it? If it is broken, who are they in violation of?
Rome.
Now, here's what I find very fascinating. The very same word for seal that is used here is the exact same word that we find in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. When Satan is bound with a great chain, put into his prison, and sealed. And what's significant about that for me is this. The same person that breaks the seal of Jesus' cave, of his tomb, is the same one that'll break the seal of Satan's tomb. And yet, the ultimate result of each of these particular individuals is drastically different, because one seal is broken and he moves to life and victory, while Satan's seal, when it is broken, he moves to his death and defeat. Do I think John did that by accident? No way. Way too cool. So, not only is there a guard there, but the imperial seal is on the tomb. Anyone that breaks it will be chased down, killed, destroyed, because you're not in violation of just the Jews, you're in violation of Rome itself. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Sabbath would have ended 6 p.m. Saturday night. Therefore, if you just said after Sabbath, it would be too vague. Since they put at dawn of the first day of the week, we know this is Sunday. Sunday morning. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb, only two out of the three. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. Violent earthquake. Sounds a lot like the crucifixion. It's almost like Matthew saying, hey, something big's happening here. And they're connected. His appearance was like lightning and his clothes were as white as snow. What does that remind you of? Jesus, that's the good answer. From what chapter? 17. What did he do there? Transfigured. The transfiguration, I was telling Daniel this morning, transfiguration to me is quite fascinating, because I do believe the transfiguration summarizes the first 16 chapters. But it also seems to be pointing forward too, because there's no reason why this reference should appear at the end if it's not pointing back to the transfiguration as well. And what happened at the transfiguration? I mean, I know Jesus was transformed, Moses and Elijah were there, but what was the significance of that event? The validation of the identity and the kingdom of Jesus. And so here, at the resurrection, you have the same language being used, which is pointing back saying, his identity and his kingdom is being validated. 2 minutes, awesome. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. That sounds like the transfiguration too, doesn't it? Because whenever the voice of God comes and speaks with the validation of who Jesus is, the disciples fall down to the ground, trembling and terrified. The angel said to the women, not to the guards, to the women, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid is a command that is only given to people that are within the community of Jesus. Because everyone else, no, they need to be afraid. Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. But Lord, thank you, he is not here. He is risen, just as he said. When did Jesus say that he was going to raise from the dead? When they're coming down the Mount of Transfiguration. He says, so the Son of Man will be betrayed and handed over to men. But don't tell anyone about who I am until after I have raised from the dead. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to his disciples. This is the first commission out of four commissions that ends the Gospel of Matthew. The first commission out of four. And this commission shakes the women in emotions that are just off the charts. It says they were excited, joyous, terrified, freaked out all at the same time. Now the Gospel of Mark ends there. Gospel of Mark ends there. But the Gospel of Matthew finishes the story. Let me say this really quick about the Gospel of Mark. I do think it ends in verse 8. I do think the Gospel ends with gar. Why? Because in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is consistently looking at people saying, don't tell anybody who I am. And what do? They go tell. He says, hey, don't tell anybody who I am. He heals the guy that is blind. He has to kind of heal him twice, shock him both times. And then the guy can see. He's like, oh, you're the Messiah. And he goes, good, don't tell anybody. And what does the guy go do? Goes and tells. The messianic secret of Mark is so fascinating because every time Jesus says, don't say it, people go and say it. The only time in the Gospel of Mark whenever someone is commanded to go and tell is in Mark chapter 16, verses 6 through 8. And that is the only time where someone doesn't go tell. And if you're in Mark's audience, the application is very clear. People that aren't told to go tell are going and telling. You've been told to go tell, so why aren't you going and telling? The Gospel of Mark ends with the finger pointing out the person that's reading it, saying, if you don't go tell, how will the resurrection power spread? Matthew continues the story with three other great commissions, and we'll get to those tomorrow on the very last day of class. I love you. See you then.